square miles between the Mississippi River and the Rocky Mountains, doubling American territory. Hamilton was ruefully amused that Jefferson, the strict constructionist, committed a breathtaking act of executive power that far exceeded anything contemplated in the Constitution. The land purchase dwarfed Hamilton's central bank and other measures once so hotly denounced by the man who was now president. After considering a constitutional amendment to sanctify the Louisiana Purchase, Jefferson settled for congressional approval. The less we say about the constitutional difficulties respecting Louisiana, the better, he conceded to Madison. To justify his audacity, the president invoked the doctrine of implied powers first articulated and refined by Alexander Hamilton. As John Quincy Adams remarked, the Louisiana Purchase was an assumption of implied power greater in itself and more comprehensive in its consequences than all the assumptions of implied powers in the years of the Washington and Adams administrations. When it suited his convenience, Jefferson set aside his small government credo without compunction. At first, Hamilton had denied that Napoleon would ever sell the territory. There is not the most remote probability that the ambitious and aggrandizing views of Bonaparte will commute, that is, exchange, the territory for money, he observed. Hamilton thought the United States should simply seize New Orleans and then negotiate a purchase of the territory with a France bankrupted by war. Perhaps Hamilton was slipping back into the old reveries of military glory that he had nursed under President Adams. Then, envious of Jefferson's easy windfall, Hamilton belittled the significance of the Louisiana Purchase, contending that any settlement in this vast wilderness appears too distant and remote to strike the mind of a sober politician with much force. In the end, Hamilton was one of the few Federalists to support the action, which squared neatly with his nationalistic vision. Swapping roles with Republicans, however, many Federalists emerged as strict constructionists and denied that the Constitution permitted the purchase. Beyond legal reservations, they worried that this new American territory would weaken Federalist power, sealing their doom. The new Western terrain would be preponderantly Republican and agricultural, and slavery might flourish there. In fact, every state that entered the Union between 1803 and 1845 as a result of the purchase turned out to be a slave state, further tipping the political balance toward the South. Fearful of being overshadowed by an expanding Republican slave empire in the West, some New England Federalists began to talk of secession from the Union. Such plans formed part of the context for the Hamilton-Burr duel. If any such secessionist movement occurred, Hamilton, ever the passionate nation-builder, wanted to retain the sterling reputation necessary to counter it with all his might. Where Hamilton saw a threat to the Union in the incipient secession movement, Aaron Burr beheld a chance to rehabilitate his flagging political career. As the 1804 presidential election approached, Burr knew that Jefferson would drop him from the Republican ticket. This assumption was reinforced on January 20, 1804, when Governor George Clinton, citing age and ill health, informed Jefferson that he would not run again for New York governor. Jefferson began to muse upon Clinton's strengths as a running mate, not least among them that he was too old to pose any competitive threat to himself and would leave the door open for James Madison to succeed him as the next president. On January 26th, Burr hazarded one last meeting with Jefferson to determine whether he had any future in the National Republican Party. Knowing it would be fruitless to ask Jefferson to keep him on as vice president, he abased himself to solicit a mark of favor from Jefferson that he could transmit to the world as evidence that he was leaving office with the president's confidence. Mixing flattery with self-pity, Burr complained that the Livingstons and Clintons, abetted by Hamilton, had launched calumnies against him in New York and asked Jefferson to help defend his name. Jefferson held out no hope of political redemption. In his evasive style, he said that he never meddled with elections and had no plans to do so now. As for press attacks against Burr, Jefferson waved them away blithely, saying that he had noticed it but as the passing wind. Clearly, as far as Jefferson was concerned, Aaron Burr was persona non grata in the Republican Party. Burr concluded that his political salvation lay in New York. He would try to exchange places with George Clinton and run for New York governor, backed by a coalition of Federalists and disgruntled Republicans. Hamilton feared that Burr might try to unite New York with New England in a breakaway Confederacy, courting Federalist votes in the process. With his talent for subtle suggestions, Burr had already dined with New England Federalist legislators, who had probed his views on the subject. Congressman Roger Griswold of Connecticut said that Burr spoke in the most bitter terms of the Virginia faction and of the necessity of a union at the northward to resist it. But what the ultimate objects are which he would propose, I do not know. Without committing himself, the inscrutable Burr kept alive hopes that, as New York governor, he might encourage state residents to forge a union with the New England states. In essaying a New York comeback, Burr had to contend with two willful opponents. 34-year-old DeWitt Clinton, now New York's handsome, overbearing mayor, and the damaged but still resourceful Hamilton. The resulting political battle was to be brutal even by the savage standards of the day. The American citizen, Clinton's mouthpiece, was to play an especially provocative role. To discredit Burr among Republicans, editor James Cheatham disinterred old charges that Burr had colluded with Federalists in the 1801 tie election. He took special pleasure in quoting Hamilton that Burr was a Catiline or traitor. This only aggravated tensions between Hamilton and Burr. In hindsight, several Burr confidants blamed Cheatham for goading the two men into a duel. The editor had done everything in his power to set Burr and Hamilton to fighting, claimed Charles Biddle. Indeed, Cheatham exploited every opportunity to bait the two men. On January 6, 1804, he had jeered openly at Hamilton in print. "Yes, sir, I dare assert that you attributed to Aaron Burr one of the most atrocious and unprincipled of crimes. He has not called upon you. Either he is guilty or he is the most mean and despicable bastard in the universe." Cheatham also prodded Burr, asking him if he was so degraded as to permit even General Hamilton to slander him with impunity. Now an embattled, lonely figure, Burr was as hypersensitive to attacks on his character as Hamilton. If he could not redeem his personal reputation, then he could not salvage his career. So that February, he filed a libel suit against Cheatham, one of 38 that the sleazy editor faced in his brief career. Cheatham mischievously responded that he was merely reiterating allegations that Hamilton had made against Burr. "I repeat it. General Hamilton believes him guilty and has said so 1,000 times, and will say so and prove him so whenever an opportunity offers." By stoking this animosity, Cheatham was playing a lethal game. The Federalists had been so debilitated in New York by the Jeffersonians that they could not even field a viable gubernatorial candidate. It therefore became a question of which Republican or independent candidate to support. Sensing the futility of any Federalist candidacy, Rufus King rebuffed Hamilton's entreaty that he run. In February, Hamilton and other leading Federalists caucused at the City Tavern in Albany to decide on a Republican candidate to back. Hamilton was in Albany to deliver his summary remarks in the Croswell case. Disconcerted by what he saw as a diabolical plot to dismember the Union, Hamilton combated Burr with special intensity. In notes prepared for his speech, Hamilton said that Burr was an adroit, able, and daring politician, and skillful enough to combine unhappy Republicans and wavering Federalists. But Burr, he said, yearned to head a new Northern Confederacy, and placed at the head of the state of New York, no man would be more likely to succeed. Aware of Hamilton's strenuous efforts to stop him, Burr informed his daughter, Theodosia, that Hamilton is intriguing for any candidate who can have a chance of success against Aaron Burr. A few months later, Burr pretended that he had had no idea of the true opinion that Hamilton entertained of his private character and summoned Hamilton to a duel on that basis. Yet on March 1, 1804, the American citizen reported that Hamilton had criticized Burr for both his public and private character. "General Hamilton did not oppose Mr. Burr because he was a Democrat, but because he had no principle, either in morals or in politics. The sum and substance of his language was that no party could trust him. He drew an odious, but yet I think a very just picture of the little colonel." In the end, Hamilton endorsed for governor one of his earliest political foes, John Lansing, Jr., whom he had first tangled with as a fellow New York delegate at the Constitutional Convention. Hamilton thought Lansing would be a weak governor who would erode Republican unity. After Lansing declined the nomination, Republicans rallied around Chief Justice Morgan Lewis, who had married into the Livingston clan. This was a terrible blow to Hamilton, who did not think Lewis could win and feared that Federalists would now defect to Burr. "Burr's prospect has extremely brightened," he lamented. Indeed, on February 18th, a caucus of disaffected Republicans nominated Burr for governor. Just as Hamilton foresaw, prominent Federalists, from John Jay to his own brother-in-law Stephen Van Rensselaer, lined up behind Burr. In disgust, Hamilton told Philip Schuyler that he would not get involved in the election, but he was incapable of inaction. He ended up campaigning for Lewis to the point that one Burr lieutenant wrote, "General Hamilton opposed the election of Colonel Burr with an ardor bordering on fanaticism." The press teemed with libels of the most atrocious character. As groups statewide endorsed Burr, "Burr is the universal, I mean the general cry," exclaimed one exuberant observer, Hamilton fell into a despondent state. In this mood, he lashed out at any efforts to impugn his character. On February 25th, 1 week after Burr was nominated, Hamilton went to the Albany home of Judge Ebenezer Purdy to confront him with reports that he had revived an old canard, that before the Constitutional Convention, Hamilton had secretly plotted with Britain to install a son of George III as an American king in exchange for Canada and other territories. To emphasize the gravity of the visit, Hamilton took along another judge, Nathaniel Pendleton, a Virginia native and later his second in the duel with Burr. With Pendleton taking notes, Purdy refused to disclose the source for his story, admitting only that the man lived in Westchester and had seen the telltale British letter in Hamilton's office. The source, in fact, was Pierre Van Cortlandt, Jr., who had clerked for Hamilton in the mid-1780s before becoming a Republican politician. More to the point, Van Cortlandt was now the son-in-law of George Clinton. Hamilton told Purdy that he was determined to trace the slander. Purdy mentioned that Governor Clinton had a copy of the British letter, and Hamilton decided to contact his old boogeyman. That same day, Clinton was nominated by the Republicans as Jefferson's running mate for vice president. Hamilton demanded of his longtime foe a frank and candid explanation of so much of the matter as relates to yourself. Clinton said that a General McComb had shown him a copy of the letter around the time of the Constitutional Convention. Hamilton insisted that Clinton send him the letter, if he retained it in his files, so that he could hunt down its source. Clinton sent a blunt, unrepentant reply, saying that he could not find the letter but precisely recollected its contents. It recommended a government for the United States similar to that of Great Britain. The American House of Lords was to be composed partly of the British hereditary nobility and partly of such of our own citizens as should have most merit in bringing about the measure. Clinton clearly gave credence to this nonsensical fairy tale, and he no longer felt any need to defer to Hamilton, who had lost his power and could now be bullied. In a guarded response, Hamilton expressed hope that if Clinton found the letter, he would hand it over to him. For 15 years, Hamilton had tried to run down the sources of the lies told about him. The effort had left him weary and dispirited, but he still could not shed the fantasy that if only he went after slander with sufficient persistence, he could vanquish his detractors once and for all. To fathom the full bitterness of Aaron Burr in the spring of 1804, one must dip into the hateful campaign literature spewed forth by his opponents during the gubernatorial race. Few elections in American history have trafficked in such personal defamation. Undeterred by Burr's libel suit, Cheatham's American Citizen engaged in ever more reckless sallies against him. Cheatham advised readers that his staff had assembled a list of upwards of 20 women of ill fame with whom Burr has been connected. Another list in his possession, he said, cited married ladies who were divorced due to Burr's seductions, as well as chaste and respectable ladies whom he has attempted to seduce. The most infamous Cheatham tale concerned a nigger ball that Burr allegedly threw at his Richmond Hill estate to woo free black voters. Supervised by his slave Alexis, described by an early Burr biographer as the black factotum of the establishment, this party was said to have featured Burr dancing with a voluptuous black woman, whom he then seduced. This election coverage set a new low for Cheatham, which is saying something. While being battered by the press, Burr had to fend off a wave of anonymous broadsides in the streets, his well-known profligacy forming the theme of many of them. Cheatham wrote some of them, including one claiming that the father of a young woman deflowered by Burr had arrived in New York to seek revenge. One by Silfid warned, "Let the disgraceful debauchee who permitted an infamous prostitute to insult and embitter the dying moments of his injured wife, let him look home." Another handbill signed, a young German, accused Burr of looting the estate of a Dutch baker to relieve his own indebtedness of $6,000. An Episcopalian informed readers that Burr meditates a violent attack upon the rights of property. Some broadsides even got around to dealing with politics. The liar, caught in his own toils, reiterated the familiar refrain that Burr had tried to swipe the 1800 election from Jefferson and now planned to dismember the Union. At his late January meeting with Jefferson, Burr had identified Hamilton as the author of unsigned broadsides against him, but no evidence of this exists. Even in private letters, Hamilton never referred to specific carnal acts committed by Burr. In that sense, he was quite discreet. Yet Burr may have thought that Hamilton secretly contributed to Federalist slander, even though most of the offensive handbills echoed articles in the American Citizen and probably originated with Republicans. From his campaign literature, it was clear that Burr, like Hamilton, felt persecuted by slander and powerless to stop it. One broadside said indignantly, "Colonel Burr has been loaded with almost every epithet of abuse to be found in the English language. He has been represented as a man totally destitute of political principle or integrity." Burr feigned indifference to the new and amusing libels published against him, as if nothing could shake his perfect aplomb. Unlike his opponents, he ran a clean, if aggressive, campaign from his John Street headquarters. He fought with his usual zest and charm, and his criticisms of Morgan Lewis fell within the bounds of propriety. Criticizing nepotism among the Livingstons and Clintons, he lent his campaign a populist tinge by styling himself a plain and unostentatious citizen who ran for office unaided by the power of innumerable family connections. To elevate Burr in Federalist eyes, his broadsides likened him to Hamilton. One sheet described him as a first-rate lawyer who stood on a par with Hamilton in point of sound argument, polished shafts, and manly, nervous eloquence, impressive and convincing reasoning. Despite the propaganda barrage directed against him, Burr thought the race was winnable, and his followers remained sanguine as the April vote approached. Oliver Wolcott Jr. considered it most probable that Colonel Burr will succeed. "It is certain that he commands a numerous and intrepid party who are not to be intimidated or subdued." Days before the election, Hamilton sounded mournful about the outcome. "I say nothing on politics," he confided to his brother-in-law, Philip Jeremiah Schuyler, "with the course of which I am too much disgusted to give myself any future concern about them." As usual, Hamilton proved too pessimistic. When the votes were counted in late April, Burr had narrowly won New York City, but he was outvoted so heavily upstate that he lost the race by a one-sided margin of 30,829 to 22,139. This stunning, unexpected defeat seemed to deal a mortal blow to Burr's career. He had 10 months left as vice president, but then what? Hounded from Washington and the Republican Party, he had failed to recoup lost ground in New York. Was Hamilton responsible for his loss in the gubernatorial race? Hamilton's friend Judge Kent dismissed this view, noting that most Federalists had voted for Burr, while the cold reserve and indignant reproaches of Hamilton may have controlled a few. It is highly unlikely that Hamilton's waning influence could have made the difference in a landslide election. John Quincy Adams observed that New York Federalists were now a minority, and of that minority, only a minority were admirers and partisans of Mr. Hamilton. Far more decisive in the outcome was President Jefferson. After assuring Burr that he never intruded in elections, He intimated to two New York congressmen that Burr was officially excommunicated from the Republican Party. This view, reported in the New York papers, stigmatized Burr among Republican loyalists. Nonetheless, Burr's admirers were adamant that Alexander Hamilton had destroyed his career. If General Hamilton had not opposed Colonel Burr, I have very little doubt but he would have been elected governor of New York, wrote Burr's friend Charles Biddle. This view was repeated by an early Burr biographer, who said that Burr had won the confidence of the more moderate Federalists, and nothing but Hamilton's vehement opposition had prevented that party's voting for him en masse. This theory ignores the awkward fact that Burr had fared very well indeed among New York Federalists. Burr's editor, Mary Jo Klein, has written, "By the week before the election, there were signs that the Federalist organization had given Aaron Burr full, if clandestine, support." After the loss, Burr kept up his usual unflappable air. Once the election results were in, he sent a letter full of fake bravado to his daughter Theodosia, in which he recounted his recent love life. He had been unable to visit a certain mistress named Celeste, he said, but had made time for his New York inamorata, identified as La G. He praised the latter for being good-tempered and cheerful, but also faulted her for being flat-chested. Then, almost as an afterthought, he mentioned the governor's race, saying that the election is lost by a great majority. Tant mieux. So much the better. This glib insouciance reflected Burr's lifelong self-protective pose of aristocratic disdain and indifference. Under this urbanity, however, grew a murderous rage against Hamilton. In his eyes, Hamilton had blocked his path to the presidency by supporting Jefferson in 1801. Now Hamilton had blocked his path to the New York governorship. Alexander Hamilton was a curse, a hypocrite, the author of all his misery. At least that's how Aaron Burr saw things in the spring of 1804. During the campaign, Hamilton had been troubled by new secession threats among Federalists. Nothing was more antithetical to his conception of Federalism. A friend, Adam Hoops, recalled running into Hamilton in Albany in early March and asking him about the secession rumors. "The idea of disunion he could not hear of without impatience," recalled Hoops, and expressed his reprobation of it using strong terms. In a tremendous visionary leap, Hamilton foresaw a civil war between North and South, a war that the North would ultimately win, but at a terrible cost. The result must be destructive to the present Constitution and eventually the establishment of separate governments framed on principles in their nature hostile to civil liberty. Hamilton was so appalled by this specter that he and Hoops talked of it for more than an hour. The subject had taken such fast hold of him that he could not detach himself from it until a professional engagement called him into court. Hamilton continued to worry about the bloody anarchy and the overthrow of the Constitution that might result from Jefferson's policies. That spring, Timothy Pickering, the ex-Secretary of State and now a senator from Massachusetts, made the rounds of Federalist leaders in New York, trying to drum up support for a runaway Northern Confederacy exempt from the corrupt and corrupting influence and oppression of the aristocratic Democrats of the South. Without support from the two large mid-Atlantic states, New York and New Jersey, such a federation would be stillborn. Pickering and the so-called Essex Junto hoped to recruit leading local Federalists. Though many New York Federalists feared the dominance of Virginia and the expansion of slavery after the Louisiana Purchase, both Hamilton and Rufus King solidly opposed any secessionist movement. Soon after Pickering's visit, Major James Fairley asked Hamilton if he had been approached about the Northern Confederacy. Fairley recalled that Hamilton said that he had been applied to in relation to that subject by some persons from the eastward. Hamilton then added, "You know there cannot be any political confidence between Mr. Jefferson and his administration and myself. But I view the suggestion of such a project with horror." The secession campaign had matured to the point that its instigators planned a Boston meeting late that fall, after Jefferson's presumed re-election. Hamilton agreed to attend, undoubtedly to dissuade participants from this self-destructive act. Some detractors tried to cast Hamilton as a Confederate in the plot when it flew in the face of his life's overwhelming passion, the strength and stability of the Union. Even Jefferson later referred to the known principle of General Hamilton never, under any views, to break the Union. Hamilton's dismay about the secessionist threat preoccupied him during the weeks leading up to the duel. His son John Church Hamilton told of one dinner party at the Grange just a week before the fatal encounter. After dinner, when they were alone, Hamilton turned to John Trumbull, and looking at him with deep meaning, said, "You are going to Boston. You will see the principal men there. Tell them from me, at my request, for God's sake, to cease these conversations and threatenings about a separation of the Union. It must hang together as long as it can be made to." Since 1787, Hamilton had never wavered in his belief that the Constitution must be preserved as long as possible, nor in his commitment to do everything in his power to make it work. He was not about to change that view now. Chapter 41, A Despicable Opinion. Sometime in March 1804, Hamilton dined in Albany at the home of Judge John Taylor, a Republican merchant and former state assemblyman who was working for the election of Morgan Lewis. Both Judge Taylor and Hamilton expressed their dread at having Aaron Burr as governor. "You can have no conception of the exertions that are being made for Burr," Taylor had told DeWitt Clinton. "Every artifice that can be devised is used to promote his cause." This private dinner on State Street triggered a chain of events that led inexorably to Hamilton's duel with Burr. Present at Taylor's table was Dr. Charles D. Cooper, a physician who had married Taylor's adopted daughter. Contemptuous of Burr, Cooper was delighted to sit back and listen to two of New York's most illustrious Federalists, Hamilton and James Kent, denounce him bluntly at the table. So exhilarated was Cooper by this virulent talk that on April 12th he dashed off an account to his friend Andrew Brown, telling him that Hamilton had spoken of Burr as a dangerous man and one who ought not to be trusted. Cooper asked a friend to deliver the letter. He later claimed it was purloined and opened. This may have been a cover story, though people often pored over private letters at local inns that served as post offices. It was not uncommon for letters to be intercepted and then turn up unexpectedly in print. Before Cooper knew it, excerpts from his letter had appeared in the New York Evening Post. Editor William Coleman evidently thought Cooper's words had been published in a handbill and needed to be refuted. He reminded readers that Hamilton had repeatedly declared his neutrality in the race between Burr and Lewis. To drive home the point, Coleman ran a letter from Philip Schuyler, repeating Hamilton's pledge to stay aloof from the race and saying that he could never have made the statement attributed to him about Burr. By writing this letter, Schuyler unwittingly became the agent of his cherished son-in-law's death. Cooper took umbrage at Schuyler's insinuation that he had invented the story, and on April 23rd wrote a second letter, this time to Schuyler, substantiating his claim that Hamilton had traduced Burr. "General Hamilton and Judge Kent have declared, in substance, that they looked upon Mr. Burr to be a dangerous man and one who ought not to be trusted with the reins of government." Cooper noted that in February, Hamilton had said as much publicly when Federalists met at the City Tavern in Albany to choose a gubernatorial candidate. But it was Cooper's next assertion that pushed relations between Hamilton and Burr past the breaking point. "Far from being irresponsible," said Cooper, "he had been unusually cautious in recounting the dinner at Taylor's. For really, sir, I could detail to you a still more despicable opinion which General Hamilton has expressed of Mr. Burr." This letter, which changed so many lives, appeared in the Albany Register on April 24, 1804. On June 18th, 7 weeks after his election defeat, Burr received a copy of the upstate paper with Cooper's letter. Whether it was sent by an irate friend or a malicious enemy, we do not know. In his cool, disdainful style, Burr had prided himself on sloughing off allegations and not dignifying them with responses. But now, banished to the political wilderness, Burr was no longer immune to criticism, and he flew into a rage. Like many people who hide hostility behind charming facades, Burr was at bottom a captive of his temper. With his insatiable appetite for political gossip, he knew that Hamilton had been maligning him for years. On two previous occasions, they had nearly entered into affairs of honor over Hamilton's statements. During his feverish efforts to prevent Burr from becoming president during the 1801 election tie, Hamilton had called him profligate, bankrupt, corrupt, and unprincipled, and had accused him of trying to cheat Jefferson out of the presidency. In October 1802, Hamilton had averted a duel over this by admitting that he had no personal knowledge of such machinations. Burr later told a friend, "It is too well known that General Hamilton had long indulged himself in illiberal freedoms with my character. He had a peculiar talent of saying things improper and offensive in such a manner as could not well be taken hold of. On two different occasions, however, having reason to apprehend that he had gone so far as to afford me fair occasion for calling on him, he anticipated me by coming forward voluntarily and making apologies and concessions. From delicacy to him, and from a sincere desire for peace, I have never mentioned these circumstances, always hoping that the generosity of my conduct would have some influence on his." Some Burr admirers have noted that while Hamilton made scathing comments about Burr, he never responded in kind. This may say less about Burr's ethics than his style. Where Hamilton was outspoken in denunciations of people, the wily Burr tended to cultivate a wary silence, a studied ambiguity in his comments about political figures. When Burr set eyes on Cooper's letter, he was still smarting from his election defeat and the apparent collapse of his career. Before 1800, he could not have acted against Hamilton because of the latter's immense influence in the Washington and Adams administrations. Then, as vice president under Jefferson, Burr knew that his political fate might rest with the Federalists and that he could not antagonize Hamilton. Now, Hamilton was fair game. He still bore the famous name, but without the power that once made it so fearsome. Joanne Freeman has written, "Burr was a man with a wounded reputation, a leader who had suffered personal abuse and the public humiliation of a lost election. A duel with Hamilton would redeem his honor and possibly dishonor Hamilton." Sometime that spring, Burr told Charles Biddle that he was determined to call out the first man of any respectability concerned in the infamous publications concerning him, recalled Biddle. He had no idea then of having to call on General Hamilton. Burr was, however, laboring under the misimpression that Hamilton had drafted anonymous broadsides against him. Perhaps Cooper's letter confirmed his hunch that Hamilton had been making mischief behind the scenes. The great mystery behind Burr's challenge to Hamilton lies in what exactly Charles Cooper meant when he said he could detail a still more despicable opinion that Hamilton had spouted against Burr. The question has led to two centuries of speculation. Gore Vidal has titillated readers of fiction with his supposition that Hamilton accused Burr of an incestuous liaison with his daughter, Theodosia. But Burr was such a dissipated, libidinous character that Hamilton had a rich field to choose from in assailing his personal reputation. Aaron Burr had been openly accused of every conceivable sin: deflowering virgins, breaking up marriages through adultery, forcing women into prostitution, accepting bribes, fornicating with slaves, looting the estates of legal clients. This grandson of theologian Jonathan Edwards had sampled many forbidden fruits. To give but one recent example of scandal, 6 months before the dinner at Taylor's, Burr had received a letter from a former lover, Mrs. Haight, that politely requested hush money. She explained that she was in a state of pregnancy and in want. "Only think what a small sum you gave me, a gentleman of your connections." She did not wish to expose him, she promised, "but I would thank you if you would be so kind as to send me a little money." If Burr did not pay her, Haight may have made good on her threat to expose him. If so, New York society would have been abuzz with the story. In the last analysis, however, the specific charge that Cooper had in mind was unimportant, for Burr was now poised to exploit any pretext to strike at Hamilton. Their affair of honor was less about slurs and personal insults than politics and party leadership. On Monday morning, June 18th, after digesting the Cooper letter, Burr asked his friend William P. Van Ness to come immediately to Richmond Hill, his home overlooking the Hudson. Burr was suffering from an ague, and his neck was wrapped in scarves. Many people, Burr told Van Ness, had informed him that General Hamilton had at different times and upon various occasions used language and expressed opinions highly injurious to my reputation. Thus it was clearly a catalogue of cumulative insults, rather than the Cooper letter alone, that had provoked Burr to action. By 11 o'clock that morning, Van Ness materialized at Hamilton's law office with a letter from Burr, sternly demanding an explanation of the despicable act alluded to in Cooper's letter. Both the tone and substance of Burr's letter telegraphed to Hamilton that Burr was commencing an affair of honor. Everything in Alexander Hamilton's life pointed to the fact that he would not dodge a duel or negotiate a compromise. He was incapable of turning the other cheek. With his checkered West Indian background, he had predicated his career on fiercely defending his honor. No impulse was more deeply rooted in his nature. This outspoken man was always armed for battle and vigilant in deflecting attacks on his integrity. On 6 occasions, Hamilton had been involved in the duel preliminaries that formed part of affairs of honor, and 3 times he had been attached to duels as a second or an advisor. Yet he had never actually been the principal in a duel. His editor, Harold C. Sirrett, has observed that until the summer of 1804, Hamilton was obsessed with dueling in the abstract, but not with duels in fact. The dueling cult was still widespread, though far from universal. Jefferson and Adams opposed dueling, and Franklin had deplored it as a murderous practice. Dueling was especially prevalent among military officers, who prided themselves on their romantic sense of honor and found this ritualized violence the perfect way to express it. Both Hamilton and Burr had been schooled in this patrician culture. Military men always feared that if they ducked a duel, they might be branded cowards, drastically impairing their future ability to command troops. Since he envisioned a host of bloody possibilities in America's immediate future, a civil war, anarchy, a secessionist revolt, and thought he might lead an army to deal with them, Hamilton dwelled on the implications for his courage in accepting or declining Burr's challenge. Courage was inseparable from his conception of leadership. Said one contemporary of Hamilton, he was a soldier and could not bear the imputation of wanting spirit. Least of all could he bear the supercilious vaunting of Aaron Burr that he had been called by him to account and shrunk from the call. Dueling was de rigueur among those, like Burr and Hamilton, who identified with America's social elite. Burr by birth, Hamilton by marriage and accomplishment. If a social inferior insulted you, you thrashed him with your cane. If you traded insults with a social equal, you selected pistols and repaired to the dueling ground. In theory, Burr could have sued Hamilton for libel, but it was thought infradig for a gentleman to do so. Hamilton said loftily that he had largely refrained from libel suits because he preferred to repay hatred with contempt. Politicians were among the most ardent duelists. Many duels arose from partisan disputes, and as Joanne Freeman has shown in Affairs of Honor, they often followed contested elections as losers sought to recoup their standing. Political parties were still fluid organizations based on personality cults, and no politician could afford to have his honor impugned. Though fought in secrecy and seclusion, duels always turned into highly public events that were covered afterward with rapt attention by the press. They were designed to sway public opinion and shape the images of the adversaries. Duels were also elaborate forms of conflict resolution, which is why duelists did not automatically try to kill their opponents. The mere threat of gunplay concentrated the minds of antagonists, forcing them and their seconds into extensive negotiations that often ended with apologies instead of bullets. Experience had taught Hamilton that if he was tough and agile in negotiations, he could settle disputes without resort to weapons. In the unlikely event that a duel occurred, the antagonists frequently tried only to wound each other, clipping an arm or leg. If both parties survived the first round of a duel, they still had a chance to pause and settle their dispute before a second round. The point was not to exhibit deadly marksmanship. It was to demonstrate courage by submitting to the duel. Further militating against a mortal ending was that many states had levied harsh penalties for dueling. Although these laws were seldom applied, especially when social luminaries were involved, the possibility of prosecution always existed. Even if no legal action was taken, the culprit might still be ostracized as a bloodthirsty scoundrel, defeating his purpose in having dueled. Hamilton could thus have assumed that he would likely emerge alive, though not unscathed, from his affair of honor with Burr. At the same time, he faced a situation in many ways unlike anything he had ever experienced. In previous affairs, Hamilton had been on the offensive, taking opponents by surprise and briskly demanding apologies and retractions. He was a past master at using this technique to muzzle specific people who had slandered him. Now he found himself on the receiving end, deprived of the righteous wrath and moral authority of being the wronged party. He could not take an aggressive, high-minded tone, since it was he who stood accused of slander. Ordinarily, Hamilton might have assumed that the worldly Burr would see that he had nothing to gain and everything to lose by murdering him. They had been colleagues for 20 years and had enjoyed each other's company. That spring, Hamilton had told a mutual friend that political disputes were more civilized in New York than in Philadelphia, and that they never carried party matters so far as to let it interfere with their social parties. He even mentioned that he and Colonel Burr always behaved with courtesy to each other. Yet Hamilton knew that Burr's career had been damaged, even ruined, and he feared that he was in a homicidal mood. Hamilton told his friend, the Reverend John M. Mason, that for several months past he had been convinced that nothing would satisfy the malice of Burr but the sacrifice of his life. At every step, Hamilton proceeded with a sense of gravity that suggested his awareness of the possibility of his impending death. Throughout his affair with Burr, Hamilton evinced ambivalence about dueling. In light of his extensive history of affairs of honor, it may seem disingenuous for Hamilton to have stated that he did not believe in duels. But with his son Philip's death and his own growing attention to religion, Hamilton had developed a principled aversion to the practice. By a spooky coincidence, in the last great speech of his career, Hamilton eloquently denounced dueling. During the Harry Croswell case, he argued that it was forbidden on the principle of natural justice that no man shall be the avenger of his own wrongs, especially by a deed alike interdicted by the laws of God and man. In agreeing to duel with Burr, Hamilton claimed to be acting contrary to his own wishes in order to appease public opinion. As his second, Nathaniel Pendleton, later wrote, dueling might be barbarous, but it was a custom which has nevertheless received the sanction of public opinion in the refined age and nation in which we live, by which it is made the test of honor or disgrace. In 1804, Alexander Hamilton did not think he could afford to flunk that test, though many friends would fault him for bowing to this popular prejudice. It is hard to escape the impression that in the early stages of negotiations, it was the headstrong Hamilton, not Burr, who was the intransigent party. The letter that William P. Van Ness carried to Hamilton's law office on June 18th demanded a prompt and unqualified acknowledgement or denial of any expression that might have justified Charles Cooper's use of the term despicable. Hamilton knew Van Ness well. They had argued the Harry Croswell case together. And he could have mollified Burr by saying that he had no personal quarrel with him and offering a bland statement of apology or regret. Instead, he adopted the slightly irritated tone of a busy man being unjustly harassed. In niggling, hair-splitting style, Hamilton objected that Burr's charge against him was too general and that if Mr. Burr would refer to any particular expressions, he would recognize or disavow them. Technically, Hamilton was correct. In affairs of honor, the aggressor was supposed to pinpoint his accusations and do so as soon after the event as possible. In his own experiences, Hamilton had cited chapter and verse about the charges. Now Burr was dragging up dinner party chatter from 3 months ago and resting everything on an adjective. For a man with Hamilton's full schedule, it was difficult, if not impossible, to recollect old table talk, and he had legitimate grounds to protest. Yet he must have suspected that Burr was trying to coax him into a duel to satisfy political purposes as well as rage. If so, he played into Burr's hands by behaving in a haughty, inflexible manner. When Van Ness said that he found his response inadequate, Hamilton promised that he would review the Albany Register. He had never even seen the Cooper quote, as well as Burr's letter, and get back to him later in the day. At 1:30 p.m., Hamilton stopped by Van Ness's home and pleaded a variety of engagements while assuring him of a response by Wednesday. He told Van Ness that he was sorry Mr. Burr had adopted the present course, that it was a subject that required some deliberation, and that he wished to proceed with justifiable caution and circumspection. On Wednesday evening, June 20th, Hamilton dropped off his response at Van Ness's home. Instead of applying balm to Burr's wounds, Hamilton struck a didactic tone and quibbled over the word despicable. 'Tis evident that the phrase still more despicable admits of infinite shades from very light to very dark. How am I to judge of the degree intended? A defensive tone crept into his prose. I deem it inadmissible on principle to be interrogated as to the justness of the inferences which may be drawn by others from whatever I may have said of a political opponent in the course of a 15 years' competition. He stood ready to avow or disavow specific charges, but he would not give Burr a blanket retraction. Then he curtly added lines that committed him to a duel. I trust, on more reflection, you will see the matter in the same light with me. If not, I can only regret the circumstance and must abide the consequences. In his acerbic reply the next day, Burr only hardened his position. He thought Hamilton had patronized him with a pedantic discourse. The question is not whether Cooper has understood the meaning of the word or has used it according to syntax and with grammatical accuracy, Burr wrote, but whether you have authorized this application either directly or by uttering expressions or opinions derogatory to my honor. Far from being appeased, Burr resolved to proceed with his challenge. Your letter has furnished me with new reasons for requiring a definite reply. At noon on Friday, June 22nd, Van Ness delivered Burr's message to Hamilton, who read it in his presence. Hamilton seemed perplexed and said that Burr's letter contained several offensive expressions and seemed to close the door to all further reply. He had hoped the answer he had returned to Colonel Burr's first letter would have given a different direction to the controversy. As if this were a legal debate or a tutorial in logic, Hamilton could not see why Burr would expect him to make a specific disavowal to a general statement. He did not appreciate the need for personal delicacy. Eager to defuse the controversy, Van Ness fairly dictated language to Hamilton that would have ended the matter. He said that if Hamilton replied to Burr, that he could recollect the use of no terms that would justify the construction made by Dr. Cooper, it would have opened a door for accommodation. But Hamilton, turning a deaf ear, repeated his original objection to a broad disavowal. Since Hamilton had refused to reply, Van Ness returned to Richmond Hill and informed Burr that he must pursue such a course as he should deem most proper. In a shockingly brief span, the two men had moved to the brink of a duel and were ready to lay down their lives over an adjective. After talking with Hamilton, Van Ness consulted with Nathaniel Pendleton. At first, Pendleton could not understand why Hamilton refused to repudiate any statement he might have made. Mr. Pendleton replied that he believed General Hamilton would have no objections to make such a declaration and left me for the purpose of consulting him, Van Ness recalled. Pendleton was chastened by his visit with Hamilton, who called Burr's letter rude and offensive and unanswerable. Later in the day, Pendleton told Van Ness that he had not appreciated the whole force and extent of Hamilton's feelings and his profound difficulty in complying with Burr's request. In a new letter, Hamilton gave Burr a good tongue-lashing, describing his expressions as indecorous and improper and making compromise ever more elusive. He tried to turn the tables on Burr, seize the moral high ground, and cast himself as the victim. It clearly bothered him that he was being asked to make amends to Burr, whom he regarded as his intellectual, political, and ethical inferior. Judge Nathaniel Pendleton was a confidant of Hamilton, who had fought in the Revolution before becoming a U.S. District Court judge in Georgia. Even though he suspected Pendleton of Republican leanings, Hamilton had developed such high respect for him that he had recommended him to President Washington as a candidate for Secretary of State. Judge Pendleton writes well, is of respectable abilities, and is a gentlemanlike, smooth man. In 1796, Pendleton moved to New York to escape the Georgia climate, which was harming his health, and he quickly established himself as a distinguished jurist. The courteous, dignified Pendleton was dismayed by Hamilton's rigidity. The truth is that General Hamilton had made up his mind to meet Mr. Burr before he called upon me, provided he should be required to do what his first letter declined, Pendleton later told a relative. And it was owing to my solicitude and my efforts to prevent extremities that the correspondence was kept open from 23 June to the 27th. Burr, it must be said, proved no less obdurate. George Clinton later told one senator that Burr's intention to challenge was known to a certain club long before it was known to Hamilton. This circumstance induced many to consider it more like an assassination than a duel. Between Hamilton's combative psychology and Burr's need to solve his political quandary, there was little room for the seconds to hammer out a deal. In replying to Hamilton's unyielding second letter, Burr obeyed the inexorable logic of an affair of honor. He wrote to Hamilton and regretted that he lacked the frankness of a soldier and the candor of a gentleman, and quoted Hamilton's ominous phrase that he was ready to meet the consequences. "This I deemed a sort of defiance," said Burr. "Thus, sir, you have invited the course I am about to pursue, and now by your silence impose it upon me." Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton had moved from frosty words to a mutual and irreversible commitment to a duel. Hamilton spent that weekend at the Grange and did not set eyes on Burr's letter until June 26th. Over the weekend, Pendleton met several times with Van Ness, trying to arbitrate a solution. If Hamilton had been the more recalcitrant one at first, it was now Burr's turn to throw up insurmountable obstacles. Pendleton thought he saw a way out of the impasse. If Burr asked Hamilton to specify whether there had been any impeachment of his private character during the Albany dinner, Hamilton could disclaim such a statement. But Burr had drawn up truculent instructions for Van Ness that precluded any such harmonious resolution. For a long time, he said, he had endured Hamilton's insults till it approached to humiliation, and he concluded that Hamilton had a settled and implacable malevolence toward him. By this point, Burr was clearly spoiling for a fight. On Monday, Pendleton asked Hamilton to recount what had been said at the Albany dinner. Hamilton's recollections were fuzzy, and he remembered only that he had spoken of the political principles and views of Colonel Burr, without reference to any particular instance of past conduct or to private character. By this point, Burr had gone far beyond the Cooper slur and upped the stakes dramatically. Van Ness told Pendleton that Burr now wanted Hamilton to make a general disavowal of any previous statements that might have conveyed impressions derogatory to the honor of Mr. Burr, and he made clear that more will now be required than would have been asked at first. Burr was deliberately making impossible demands, asking Hamilton to deny that he had ever maligned Burr at any time or place in his public or private character. Hamilton could not sign such a document, which would have been untrue and which Burr might have brandished in future elections as an endorsement. Hamilton must have feared that such a concession would strip him of standing in Federalist eyes and make military leadership difficult. Burr's provocation only adds to the suspicion that the despicable statement was just a transparent pretext to pounce on Hamilton. After discussing the latest demands with Hamilton, Pendleton reported back to Van Ness that Hamilton now perceived predetermined hostility on Burr's part. At this point, a confrontation was unavoidable. On Wednesday, June 27th, Van Ness delivered to Pendleton a formal duel request. Henceforth, Burr would entertain no further letters from Hamilton, and all communication would take place between the seconds. Duels tended to occur post-haste to prevent the secret from leaking out. But this duel was scheduled at a relatively distant date, July 11th, for reasons that speak well of Hamilton. The New York Supreme Court was holding its final session in Manhattan on Friday, July 6th, and Hamilton felt duty-bound to satisfy clients who had lawsuits pending. His sense of professional responsibility was impeccable. He told Pendleton, "I should not think it right in the midst of a circuit court to withdraw my services from those who might have confided important interests to me and expose them to the embarrassment of seeking other counsel who may not have time to be sufficiently instructed." He also needed time to put his personal affairs in order. For the next 2 weeks, Hamilton hid the situation from Eliza and the children, as Burr did from his daughter Theodosia. Only a handful of politically well-connected people in New York knew of the unfolding drama. Once a duel was agreed upon, Hamilton had to reconcile the two glaringly incompatible elements of the situation: his need to fight to preserve his political prestige and his equally powerful need to remain true to his avowed opposition to dueling. He opted for a solution chosen by honorable duelists before him. He would throw away his fire, that is, purposely miss his opponent. This was the strategy Hamilton's son Philip had disastrously followed in his duel. It was likely Hamilton himself, writing in the New York Evening Post, who gave this description of Philip's approach. Averse in principle to the shedding of blood in private combat, anxious to repair his original fault as far as he was able without dishonor, and to stand acquitted to his own mind, he came to the determination to reserve his fire, receive that of his antagonist, and then discharge his pistol in the air. Only after Philip threw his fire away was his second supposed to announce his reason for doing so and try to resolve the dispute. Aside from Pendleton, Hamilton confided his plan to waste his shot to Rufus King, the former minister to Great Britain, and a very moderate and judicious friend who tried several times to talk him out of it. King found dueling abhorrent, but told Hamilton that he owed it to his family and the rights of self-defense to fire at his antagonist. King sneaked out of town the morning of the encounter, leading to criticism that he had acted cravenly when he could have headed off the catastrophe. King said that even though Hamilton had the most capacious and discriminating mind he had ever known, he rigidly followed the rules known as the Code Duello. Pendleton was likewise horrified at Hamilton's decision to throw away his shot and exhorted him not to decide lightly, but take time to deliberate fully. Hamilton would not listen. As so often in his career, the Reynolds and Adams pamphlets spring to mind, he became possessed by a notion and would not let it go. In this frame of mind, and in spite of his son's experiences, he was impervious to reason. Hamilton's decision has given rise to speculation that he was severely depressed and that the duel was suicidal. Henry Adams phrased it, "Instead of killing Burr, Hamilton invited Burr to kill him." Historian Douglas Adair has evoked a guilt-ridden Hamilton who planned to atone for his sins by exposing himself to Burr's murderous gunfire. In 1978, four psychobiographers studied the duel and also concluded that it was a disguised suicide. It is indisputable that in Hamilton's final years he was seriously depressed by personal and political setbacks, and his judgment was often spectacularly faulty. Long beguiled by visions of a glorious death in battle, he had also never lost a certain youthful ardor for martyrdom. Yet in the duel with Burr, he obeyed the antique logic of affairs of honor. Because he followed a script lost to later generations, his actions seemed lunatic rather than merely rash and wrong-headed. He did not think of this course of action as suicidal, Joseph Ellis has written, but as another gallant gamble of the sort he was accustomed to winning. While the duel shocked many contemporaries, Hamilton and Burr partisans understood its logic, even if they did not endorse it. Attorney David B. Ogden said that his friend Hamilton knew that if he did not duel, it would, in a great measure, deprive him of the power of being hereafter useful to his country. Likewise, William P. Van Ness said that Burr had to defend his honor, for if he tamely sat down in silence and dropped the affair, what must have been the feelings of his friends? Hamilton gambled that Burr would not shoot to kill. He knew that Burr had nothing to gain by murdering him. Burr would be denounced from every pulpit as an assassin, and it would destroy the remnants of his career. Since he had provoked the duel to rehabilitate his career, it did not make sense for him to kill Hamilton. Hamilton calculated, correctly it turned out, that Burr could not kill him without committing political suicide at the same time. This did not rule out the possibility, of course, that Burr might kill him accidentally, or that he might submit to a murderous rage that overrode his political interests. If Burr did kill him, Hamilton knew, he would at least have the posthumous satisfaction of destroying Burr's alliance with the Federalists. On the other hand, Hamilton never wavered in his belief that if he did not face Burr's fire, he would lose standing in the political circles that mattered to him. With an exalted sense of his place in history, he viewed himself as a potential savior of the Republic. He once told a friend, "Perhaps my sensibility is the effect of an exaggerated estimate of my services to the United States, but on such a subject every man will judge for himself." The antagonists approached their rendezvous in starkly different personal situations. Hamilton had a large family of dependents, Eliza and seven children ranging in age from 2 to nearly 20. Some observers criticized Hamilton for having recklessly jeopardized his family to salvage his reputation. Burr, by contrast, was a widower with a daughter, Theodosia, who had married into the wealthy Alston family of South Carolina. He did not need to worry about the financial aftermath of his death. Deeply conflicted about the duel, Hamilton displayed a fatalistic passivity. When King told Hamilton that Burr undoubtedly meant to murder him and that Hamilton should prepare as best he could, Hamilton replied that he could not bear the thought of taking another human life, to which King retorted, "Then, sir, you will go like a lamb to be slaughtered."